You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com.
Government policy has a cost. Every law and regulation passed by the government has a human toll. The Cost, a series of We Are Libertarians, is a one-on-one interview that tells the story of an average person as they deal with the outcome of policy. I'm Chris Spangle, I'm your host, and today we'll be talking to Jerome Caldwell and Richard Samuels about what it's like to live inside the prison system. I'm joined by Brett Bittner in this interview, and just an update, both Richard and Jerome are doing well and continue to give back to their community. Here now are Richard and Jerome's story. This is a continuation of episode 160. Brett and Chloe went out to Freedom Works and attended a seminar.
Yeah, we were talking. It was the hashtag Justice for All Summit that Freedom Works put together with writers from across the country, activists from across the country, to talk about justice reform, talking about what happens currently in the justice system, talking about what can make it better, talking about reversing the ideas of being tough on crime, rather to be right on crime.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a lot about overcriminalization. We talked about the disparity between racial arrest records. We talked about the disparity in sentencing. We talked about mandatory minimums. We talked about the fact that there is not anything that is really helping to rehabilitate. We talked in the last episode about the four pillars of justice. Mm-hmm. When it comes to incarceration. But there's very little focus on rehabilitation to making sure that the 95% of people who are in jail or prison, one day they're going to get out.
Sure.
And at the end of the day, we need to make sure that those people are productive members of society, because we cannot continue to lock away people in a cage because we don't like the behavior that they choose.
Do they have a project page, or just go to freedomworks.org?
This is their big deal. They're lobbying. Their focus is having stuff like this happen all over the country. They're working with several other groups. I know they're working against families, against mandatory minimums. They're working with the Faith and Freedom Coalition. They're working with traditionally more right-leaning think tanks and groups that are lobbying. But it's their major initiative and has been for the last year or so. And it was an honor to be invited and to participate and to hear some of the things that we don't normally hear when we're watching CNN or we're watching the nightly news. We're too busy with apartment fires and some of the terrible things that are happening in our communities, and we're not talking about what's happening behind bars.
Right. So check out FreedomWorks. Google them. I think it's freedomworks.org.
It is.
And thank you to Jason Pye and everybody at FreedomWorks for sharing the last episode, and hopefully they'll share this one as well. Now, we actually are going to have an event here in Indianapolis around this issue later this month.
Yes, July the 28th.
All right, July the 28th. We're going to talk to you more about that later. And it is through America's Future Foundation.
Yes, it is.
And you can check out the AFF. If you go to the front page of We Are Libertarians, scroll down. There's an AFF Indianapolis link. Click that. Find out more. We'll have the Facebook event up there soon. So be sure to join us later in the month as we host a live seminar. Mm-hmm. on this. Not a seminar. I don't know. That sounds boring.
Yeah, it's a panel.
It's discussion. More like show up. We'll give you free drinks. Sure. And free
well,
food.
Well, a free drink.
Okay.
Calm down, Chris.
And then we will educate you and have a little discussion about these very issues that we will be talking about today. The one that we talked about on episode 162 and 160. Justice reform is very near and dear to my heart, and I think most libertarians' hearts. If you are bored and you've got nothing to do, before we jump into the program, I'm going to plug The House I Live In, the documentary on Netflix, one more time.
It's not on Netflix anymore.
Well,
I was looking for it the other night because I was going to watch it again, and instead I watched Kids for Cash,
all right,
which I highly recommend. It's a terrible story, but it's good to know what's happening.
On that links page on We Are Libertarians, on the front page, we've got a link to The House I Live In. Buy it. Share it with your friends. It's amazing. Maybe send an email to Netflix and make them put it back. All right. So when we last left you on part one of this, in episode 160... We were talking to Darone and Richard about their experiences in prison. We talked about what it's like to get arrested, what it's like to go into the prison system, to go through the sentencing phases, and we never really, in that two-hour conversation, got to what it's like to leave the justice system and then get back out into the real world. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today, and I think a lot of a lot of what has happened over the last few days in, and really the past year, but you know, the murders of Castile and Sterling have obviously brought this to the front page, and then the assassination of police officers in Dallas have brought this discussion to the forefront. And we're going to continue that discussion, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I wanted, because I think obviously what Castile apparently was stopped over the last couple years 52 times. And so if you are stopped 52 times and you have a concealed carry and you're a young black man, there's going to be a 53rd time where you get killed. There's just no way around it. It's a law of averages. You know, when you are stopped for taillights and speeding and other minor traffic offenses, which police do that because then they can, you know, if they pull you over for the taillight or if they pull you over for the headlight that's out, then maybe they smell marijuana, maybe they smell something else, and they can get a bigger charge, a bigger collar that will then help them with their statistics and help them move up the ranks. Again, a law of perverse, a system of perverse incentives.
And I forgot about the revenue generation. Tickets and
yeah, exactly.
The court costs.
Here's a guy who had, Castile has been, he has paid the government $9,600 through those 52 arrests.
And not 52 arrests.
Or 52 stops.
Yes.
Well, technically you're arrested. Try and flee from the cops when you're pulled over with the lights behind you. But $9,600, I'm guessing to a guy like Castile, it is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't look like he was a rich guy.
He worked for the school system,
right.
In the lunchroom. Certainly not a high paying job. Certainly not a, well insured job,
right.
As health insurance goes.
So $9,600 out of his pocket, taxation is theft. Stolen out of his pocket through minor offenses, and then the 53rd time he paid with his life. You know, we covered that incident in the last episode, so if you want to hear more of our thoughts on that, we will get into it. But should we start with... Let's start with the exit of the prison system, because I imagine that will then fold into our discussion about... You know,
yes, it will.
Life on the street as a young black male. Just to recap, if you didn't get a chance to listen to 160, Jerome Caldwell, you were in prison for 18 years.
Yes.
You maintain your innocence.
Yes.
You went into the prison system and were basically railroaded by the police.
Yes.
You signed a document that you didn't really, it's not that you weren't cognizant, it's just that you were just signing it to get home. You
yes.
were a 19-year-old scared kid.
Yes.
And then spent 18 years in prison for something that, again, you maintain you did not do.
Yes.
And Richard, you have been in and out of prison for a total of 26 years.
Yes.
You admit that you did do some of the stuff.
Most of it.
Right, most of it. And you went in... How old were you when you first went into prison?
18.
18. Yes. So, and how old are you guys now? Richard?
I am 56.
56, all right.
41.
41, okay. So a good majority of your life has been spent inside the prison system. And we talked a lot about the mental games that the system plays with you, not just the mental and emotional games that go on with police, with prosecutors, with other inmates inside. And in that episode, we discussed, you know, growth and how to handle those things, and even down to things like the food. The food is all soy-based, which is terrible and destructive to the human body. Soy is responsible for man boobs. That's all. Gentlemen?
And it makes you very angry and very violent.
Right.
So, which I'm sure helps.
Yes.
When you're locked up and in prison.
Yeah.
So, let's start, Jerome, with you, as you...
you are nearing the end of your sentence.
Yes.
And you were originally put in there. How long was your sentence supposed to be?
45 years.
45 years. Yes. Okay. And then how did you get out in 18?
Well, back then you do half your time, so I would have had to do 22 and a half. But then when I got there, they gave me so many opportunities to try to get out earlier by college degrees, by getting vocations, by getting to just staying out of trouble.
Sure.
And I accomplished that, so they let me out in 18 years instead of 22 years.
Mm-hmm.
And
now, was that a surprise to you to get out earlier?
Considering the age I went in and how it's so terrible in there, and I didn't allow myself to get caught up into the prison life, as we call it.
Right.
It surprised me that I made it out.
Sure.
And I guess once I made it out, well, when I was there, about 2 weeks before I got out, they put me in some kind of class and said, well, this is your rehabilitation class. After 18 years.
They finally start rehabilitating you. Yeah.
In 2 weeks, they expected me to learn how to make it out here.
Right.
Once again, after 18 years.
So what does the class involve?
How to put a condom on.
Really?
Honestly.
That's an important lesson.
Yeah. How to, I won't say do a resume, because they didn't teach us how to do one, but they told us how to do it.
Sure.
They didn't teach us how to do it.
Sure.
Now, why in college they taught us, and I learned that way,
mm-hmm.
because the person who taught us there, I don't think he knew how to do a resume.
Right, in the rehabilitation
class, yes. Okay. And taught us how to not come back, and that's it. They never.
Which what were the bullet points on that?
Stay away from officers.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Have no, what they call it is have no police contact.
Basically.
Okay. So you see a police officer. So because why?
Because you're an ex-offender, which my story about when I got a ticket a month ago, 2 months ago, and I got stopped, and the officer came, he got my ID. And then he went back to his car and came back and just talked about my prison life. Oh, I see you just got out of prison. I see this. Never once said, well, you did this.
Right.
He just started talking about, well, I hope you can make it out here. And I'm like, where did this come from? Just if
right.
I did something wrong, tell me what I did wrong, then let me go.
Mm-hmm.
But he just wanted to talk about prison the whole time.
That's bizarre.
Yes.
One of the things I think that feeds into the no officer contact is the idea that when you do have contact with an officer, it's because you've done something wrong.
Yes, yes.
It does not necessarily reflect the reality of the situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that has unfortunately invaded the mindset of a lot of America. We talk about when somebody is questioned, it's like it used to be when someone was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
When someone is arrested, it's like we used to talk about somebody who's been convicted. When they're convicted, well, it's still the same.
Right.
It's just a question of how long they're going to be in jail. But we see that today where even when I'll bring up the FBI investigation of Jared Fogle with regard to the child pornography.
Former Subway spokesman.
Former Subway spokesman. You know, they were already talking about the time he was going to be spending in prison before that investigation was over,
mm-hmm.
because he had contact with the FBI and there was an investigation. No talk about why they were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
People were just speculating about what was happening, and they were estimating how long he was going to be in prison and what it was for, and that he's clearly a bad person, and we're already making the jokes that I can't stand with regard to talking about prison. Because if we made those same jokes about a woman on a college campus, it would be have a very different outcome.
Right.
And so we've seen that change in the way that people talk about justice, because it isn't necessarily justice that we're seeking. We're looking to hold someone responsible. And as soon as we have somebody, well, we need to close this case and we've got justice. Congratulations, guys.
Right.
High fives all around.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter that it could have been the wrong person. Doesn't matter that the sentence didn't fit the crime. It doesn't matter that maybe the crime shouldn't be a crime. We are just talking about justice in a very perverse way, and that's closing a case. And we touched on that last time.
It's proved your innocence.
Right. Well, which goes back to his original point that when you're pulled over, you're basically considered convicted.
Absolutely.
Already. You're basically, no matter what has happened, and no matter how the stop goes, later on, if it's viewed, because he stopped you, you had to be doing something wrong.
Sure.
And so that's just the pervasive attitude of our community and society as a whole. If the police stop you, you must be doing something wrong. And now that we have the advent of instant video, and you said something that was kind of interesting at the beginning of the cast, when you said that the police officers were assassinated, and that the Castile and Sterling were murdered.
Absolutely.
I believe that all of those individuals were assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And because we use different wording, and I know you didn't mean anything by it, you were just simply speaking, but a lot of times in the media, people will use the harsher words because it was a police officer,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the citizens don't get that same, and that's what we were talking about earlier.
Sure.
The way things are portrayed and how it's viewed, and I just believe that it's so important that we level the playing field, and when someone is killed unjustly, it's just that they were killed unjustly, not, mm-hmm. This guy was killed, but these people were assassinated. And, making it seem like more sinister. And
well, my reasoning for that is that it was intent, because the gentleman that went and killed the Dallas police officers clearly had intent to kill.
True.
And I don't know if the police officers in those two cases had the intent to kill, but they definitely committed murder. I don't know if their intent. I mean, if you listen in the Castile video, you listen to the police officer's tone of voice. He's absolutely frantic. He's losing. I mean, he's clearly disturbed by what has happened. So that's why I use the distinction. But I do maintain that all of them are wrong. That. The loss of any life,
including them sending the robot in to blow him up.
Yes,
that was good an assassination, and that was well thought out. So,
right.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, it's an unpopular position to call for due process for someone who has been involved in a premeditated murder,
like Christopher Dorner, who was the former LAPD cop who went and killed a bunch of LAPD cops, and then he was found at Great Bear Lake, and then they just
torched the cabin.
They torched the cabin that he was in. It didn't. He never got a trial.
Oh,
he was an ex LAPD officer, black officer, who went around, and he was mentally ill, and he went and
he was also retaliating for perceived injustice with regard to his release from the police department as well.
So, and instead of capturing him, they had the cabin surrounded. They just lit the cabin on fire. It's about 2 or 3 years ago.
I remember that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the lack of due process afforded to a cop killer is an issue in my mind. I mean, I would rather know why. I don't know the name of the Dallas shooter. I'm not going to learn it. I'm not going to mention it here. I'm not going to honor anybody who commits mass killings on our program. But I do think that we need to understand why people like this do what they do. You know,
there's value in knowing why.
Right. And just sending in a robot and blowing him up doesn't help us avoid the next instance of this sort of thing.
Well, I mean, you think of all of the serial killers that they have captured, and they wanted to get into the minds of the serial killer to find out, mm-hmm. Why did you do these things? Mm-hmm. It makes you wonder.
Yeah. So as you exit, mm-hmm. What is the process for being released from prison? Mm-hmm.
I just go in, and it's a counselor. I think everyone's assigned a counselor,
mm-hmm.
and you go in and talk to them, and just fill out a whole bunch of release papers.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, that's it. You fill out these papers. They ask you who's coming to get you, and go see your parole officer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Okay, so then what? I think there's different. You were on house arrest. There's parole. Yes. There's
probation.
Yes. What are the differences between some of those things?
Well, me, I got out a little earlier than the 18 years. Well, I'm supposed to do 18 and a half years. Well, they only made me do 18 and put the other half on house arrest.
Okay.
And house arrest, I was on GPS where they knew my every move. I had a monitor on my ankle.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to stay at my house and unless I went to work or went to church or looked for a job.
Right.
Other than I just had to stay in the house for 6 months.
And you were allowed 2 hours a day to go look for a job?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, he kind of cut it down to an hour and a half. I don't know why. He never told me.
Hmm.
And I was happy just to get out for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So I didn't complain. And then once, and since I wasn't officially released out of prison yet, I didn't start parole until my house arrest time was over.
Okay.
And so I'm off parole this month.
Congratulations.
So
what is the difference between parole and probation?
I've never been on probation.
Very
so
different.
I don't...
The two are very different. Actually, parole is less invasive.
Mm-hmm.
Parole just says, come in once a month. Make sure that, you know, you talk to us, let us know what you're doing, let us know where you've been looking for employment, that type of thing. Probation, you have to call the drug hotline every day. I think we talked about that a little bit. You have to do random drug testing.
So what do you call the drug hotline and go, hey, haven't done drugs today?
No, what you do is you dial the number. And it will tell you whether you're scheduled for a drop or not.
Ah, okay.
And gotcha. So every day you have to call because you never know when they're going to say, you are scheduled for a drop on this date at this time, da, 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 da. If you don't call and you're scheduled, then you violated your probation, the conditions of your probation. And then, of course, you go back through into the system. You know, you go before the judge, you know, we want to know why you didn't, you know, do what you were supposed to do. And
Right. Usually
it either lands you back in prison or, you're, given a warning of some kind to say, if this happens again, you're immediately going back to the DOC. So, as far as being released, we were put into, a reentry class, okay, because, you know, that's the big watchword now, reentry. But basically what they do is they show you a video. In that room, however, usually on countertops and desks that fill the room, there are brochures and pamphlets for Indiana HIP 2.0, you know, a lot of the resources that may be out here in the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just provide you with paperwork that you can pick up. But they don't consider that some people can't read and write.
HIP is health insurance.
Health insurance, absolutely.
Yeah. So for our non-in-state people.
Yeah, and, you know, there are several different things to choose from. So, you know, you really need someone to kind of, if you don't know, if you're not aware, if you can't read, you know, there are a lot of issues. If you have mental health issues, which a lot of people do, you really need some type of one-on-one guidance through this to understand the information. Because if you don't, you're just walking out of there with a little booklet of the things that you picked up, you know, bus routes, that type of thing. And then you're out. Of course, the first thing that you have to do is report to your probation officer. I had probation. I didn't have parole. 2 years probation, which I completed in February of this year. It was difficult. It was really difficult. Probation was a lot harder than the last 6 months of my sentence in prison. You know, I mean, because it's out here, it's different. It's always you're looking over your shoulder, wondering, are you about to go back to prison?
Mm.
And that's the. It's almost like you're walking on landmines, and you have to be very careful of where you step. Opportunity that you have or, you know, to find employment, you better be looking for it. Because if you don't, when you are scheduled to see, and when you first come home, you have to see a probation officer once a week, as well as calling every day for the drug hotline. So it's like, you know, they have a tight leash on you.
after your first 30 days, 30 to 45 days, then it becomes twice to two to three times a month. Then after 90 more days, it becomes twice a month. And then after that, it becomes like maybe once a month. Mine, but that's based upon what type of crime and that type of thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because of my criminal history was so bad, I had to go twice. I was there once every 2 weeks, all the way through to the end. Mm-hmm. They never gave me that limited, whereas I could call once a month and everything was fine. And, you know, it was difficult. And you never realize it. You never realize that you have a leash on you until you have a leash on you.
Sure.
You know, you never really understand how limited your movements are, how limited, you know, just basically going through the day is. And when you have someone watching over you to say, well, wait a minute. No, you can't do that. You know, why are you doing that? And the sad thing is as I was progressing, because, you know, when I first came home, I got a job with, I was blessed. I got a job with Micrometals as a welder. Mm-hmm. I went to a little welding class and they hooked me up, you know, started MIG welding and was doing really well. I was making $18 an hour, which to me, that was like, ooh, yeah. I'm making a lot of money.
Sure.
Especially going from 25 cents, you know, a day, right. You know what I mean? So I thought I was, you know, living the dream. And 4 months later, they called us in on a Sunday. Never forget it. It was like the week before Thanksgiving. And they said, because we worked on the weekends as opposed to working during the weekend. So we were able to get a lot of hours in. And they just basically said, well, your shift is being discontinued.
Mm.
No warning, no nothing. You know, you'll get your check and that's it. You know, and so someone who has come from absolute zero making money and all the hoops that I had to jump through in order to try and get a job and to finally find a decent job to now, my biggest worry and fear was not the fact that I lost the money that I was earning. It was going back to my probation officer saying I lost my job.
Right.
I was more afraid of that than going home to tell my fiance that, hey, you know, I lost my job because I know she's been sticking with me for 23 years. So
sure.
She ain't going nowhere. You know right. what I mean? It's just another hoop or hurdle that we have to jump over. But right. to go back and say that to my probation officer was a big deal.
Right. What are the costs that you are immediately given by the justice system when you leave? I mean, I'm sure you have to pay for the ankle bracelet.
Right.
Yeah. What are some of the costs that you face?
Well, when I went in there to get it on, they didn't tell me any price. And then I went home. Then my first visit there, he told me I owed him $1,000. So I asked him, how am I going to pay that? I don't have a job. I just got out of prison after doing so many years. How am I going to pay it? Well, you got 6 months to come up with. And if you don't, you have bad credit.
Right.
Because we'll report it to the credit bureau. So I'm like, I don't know what to do. So I'm out there. I'm trying to look for a job. I'm not getting one.
Right.
Because I got an ankle bracelet on. To me, that was a stopper there. Because if they knew who I was, they might give me a chance. But once they see that, no, we don't want him right now. And so for a long time, I still didn't pay not one payment on that. So now I'm thinking, man, I'm going to have bad credit. I just got out. I really didn't know what credit
yeah,
was.
Yeah, do you really even yeah. have a concept of yeah. what that might mean yeah. or not?
And so I finally got a job through Rupert's Kids,
mm-hmm.
and we kind of dealt with the issue of the court costs and all that. And then after that, I was at Rupert's Kids doing well. I thought I was. And then one day I said, "Hey, I think I can go out there and try to get another job now. I think I achieved what I needed to achieve and learned what I needed to learn at Rupert's Kids." So I started going out. I kept getting turned down over and over. So I just got discouraged. Like, I don't want to be here anymore, but I have to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to keep looking. Then I landed Micrometal.
Mm-hmm.
Through a temporary service. Mm-hmm. And I worked there. And after my 90 days, they loved me. They wanted to hire me. Do you have a felony? Yes, I do. Well, that may stop you.
Mm.
So we fought me. I stayed there longer and longer. Then they called me up here and said, you know what? We're going to hire you anyway. You're a hard worker.
Yeah.
So I got blessed that way. And then at Michael Mental, I started my other job as a part-time. And then they called me in one day and said, we're going to make you full-time. You work hard. And to me saying this, it just, some people come out of prison, don't get a chance to prove that they are hard workers and they're not bad people because we came out of prison.
Right.
And then a lot of employers don't want to see that. To me, they just don't want someone in their establishment that has a record because.
Or they don't want, you know, the, you've got an ankle bracelet, yeah, you violate,
stigma.
Then you're gone. Yeah. You go back and then they've put time and training into somebody that,
right,
you know, could be gone at any moment.
Well, and the other thing that I noticed as somebody who worked HR previously in a previous career,
right,
there are things that you have to fill out as the employer of a felon who has probation, who has parole.
Yes.
That says, yes, they were here at work. Yes, right, they came to look for a job.
Extra paperwork.
So there's extra paperwork just when you meet for an interview, if you do get an interview. Then when you do hire them on, you're taxing their employer, not taxing in a tax money way, but taxing them in a time and effort way just for the simple fact that they hired somebody.
Well, and because they're going to have somebody. They're going to have to pay some employee to do that work,
right?
To basically follow you, to see that they're following you and making sure that you're doing what you're supposed to do, as well as the bonding situation. They may have a situation where you're bonded and that type of thing. So definitely it's extra paperwork and extra man hours.
But my question is, when do it stop? I do understand it. I mean, at the beginning, if you're on parole, probation, and they have to do all this, but once the person that's an ex-felon that's not on this anymore, when do it stop?
Well, usually it stops once you're off of paper.
Yeah.
Because then there's no one tracking you anymore.
Yeah.
Right. So. I didn't have that situation because usually what happened was they went back to jail.
Okay.
Before they were done, they would just not show up one day. And I mean, we're talking a minimum wage job at a movie theater. You're not expecting that you're going to be able to go back, and we didn't do background checks, but we did know when somebody had, you know, when after they got the job and they presented us with the paperwork that we had to fill out for their probation or parole officer, and we were filling it out and we were keeping up with them, and then all of a sudden they would just not show up again. The only assumption that we could make was, well, they went back to jail or they hated the job and did something else.
And I'd like to also try to appeal to, I think, Daron's point as well, is that people are under the assumption that when you come out of prison that you're going to go back to being lazy and not want to do anything. Prisoners are people who, ex-offenders, are probably some of the best people that you can employ. They are at a position in life where usually if they have gone through the hardships of prison, they've learned something. We may not say that they've turned their lives around and that they're completely wonderful people now, whatever, but they've learned something.
You learn the most through any kind of adversity.
Adversity, absolutely. Yeah. And I just think that it's important that people realize that the loyalty that people have with those who give them a chance is a big deal.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, personally, I do a lot of things in the community, a whole lot of things. But at night, I work as a janitor. The reason that I work as a janitor still is because they were the ones that gave me the first opportunity.
Sure.
When I came home, when no one else would hire me, this little cleaning company said, we'll give you a part-time job, 3 hours a night, you know, just to help you get on your feet. And I've stayed with them for almost 2 years now just because they gave me an opportunity.
Yeah.
Even though I've grown past the point of needing the type of money that they're giving me.
The mindset that I hear from the two of you coming out of prison is different than the mindset that I have towards a career, where I look at it from a position of, you know, well, I can do whatever I want. I can achieve whatever I want. Right. I can, you know, I'm my own.
Good point.
I'm my own man. Where almost it's like, you guys are saying I'm not in control. I've got
right.
There's right. some the society is in control of me, and I've kind of got to go along to get along. I'm not saying that it's a low self-esteem thing. I'm saying that's kind of how it is.
It's a mentality adjustment because I'm getting there. I'm getting to the point where now, because of what I'm doing in the community and being involved in a lot of activism and that type of thing, mm-hmm. I'm beginning to understand that. That the world is my oyster.
Yeah,
mentality.
You're a master of your own future, as opposed exactly. to a victim of your circumstance.
Right, and I think that that fear that we have of returning to incarceration
mm-hmm.
keeps us limited in our thinking as far as going out here and obtaining certain types of employment.
Right.
You know, oh man, you know, I don't really have a GED. I didn't graduate from high school. I don't have this or I don't have that. Fortunately, you know, like Daron and myself, we were there at a time when college was still being offered. GEDs are still, of course, being offered. They have vocational training in prison. And so on our way out, we were able to secure avenues of employment, for employment. I know you have a degree or two, and I have 2 degrees, was unable to complete the bachelor's, got what I'm 4 credits short of my bachelor's degree, and have a couple of associate's degrees. But
by the way, I dropped out of college.
Oh, wow.
So,
and you're doing so well.
Yeah, you know, you look at society and you go, all right, well, these guys have way more college degrees than Chris Spangle does.
Well,
you know?
but
and he's the host of a very successful,
very successful.
The most successful libertarian podcast in Indiana. So, yeah, so, so all told, so you've got these court costs, and I've heard Rupert talk about it 100 times. Yeah. I mean, it's, you get out and you've got $100 to the courts. You got $150 for the ankle bracelet. So you got $1,000 for this. Got a, you know, and so many guys go back because it's hard to find employment, and so you just go back to the old way of coping, which is I'm gonna go steal. I'm gonna go, you know,
and that's
because I'm not going back to prison, so I might as well go steal, and then they, you know, they get caught.
85% of the people who return to prison for TRVs.
Meaning?
And what a TRV is a technical rule violation.
Hmm.
Technical rule violations are you had a dirty drop, or you missed nothing. They didn't commit another crime.
Right.
They just basically didn't go by the rules of probation, mm-hmm. parole, the ankle bracelet, or whatever.
Sure.
And so basically they're now sent, and this is 85% of the people who return. So you're saying only 15% of the people are actually committing new crimes. And so that just tells you that it's a systematic thing where it's just a revolving door. We haven't even mentioned if you have anger management classes, you know, because when you go into prison, and usually when you come out, they're saying, well, there's somebody that decides, well, this person needs anger management. You might talk to me for 10 minutes. Well, I think you need anger management. Well, that costs, and you're immediately assessing that cost to me. I have no decision, you know, in that process when you say, well, he needs anger management because you don't like the way I answered a question or whatever, you know. And so when you assign those things to me, you're also assigning cost that comes with them.
Right.
Well, and to further that, my sister had a run-in with the law and did a pretrial diversion program that allowed her to not spend any time in jail. But one of the conditions that had absolutely nothing to do with why she was arrested was that she take she's participating in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it had absolutely nothing to do with what she was arrested for. She didn't have a problem with alcohol. In fact, she met people there that drank and got her more into a partying lifestyle.
Okay.
And so it ended up that it wasn't good for her,
beneficial.
But she still had to go through it for 6 months, which is an interesting thing to see that, you know, you have somebody that decides, well, you need to go to AA, but you don't have an alcohol problem. They just want you to go. They want to have a rule.
And it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder the connection of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Of this person is telling me that I have an anger management issue. how are you connected to the people who are that are asking me for money for this anger management issue?
Sure.
You know, there's just such a connection with the DOC, the Department of Corrections, and I really hate that term, the Department of Corrections, because they are not correcting anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't even call it the Department of Rehabilitation because they're not rehabilitating anything or anyone.
Well, no, they're due 2 weeks at the end where they tell you how to wrap your Jimmy.
Exactly.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And
so don't go procreate and have any more people like you.
Right.
And I mean, you know what I mean? Right. It's like, really? So, yeah.
I mean, did you not know how to use a condom before you went into jail, Jerome?
Like they didn't think so.
But they're doing the world a favor because we're not going to create another Jerome.
Right. Yeah, that sounds very Nazi-like. Yeah, I mean, David Simon in the house I live in, there's a quote, and I've extracted it and put it on our Facebook page in the videos, and We Are Libertarians, where he basically talks about, you know, let's just be honest. Let's say what this is. The bottom 15%, the factories are closed, the mills are closed, the fabric mills are closed in the South. You know, we have destroyed economies, and for the bottom 15%, we've just got no jobs for them. So let's pass stringent drug laws, and let's just decide, we'll just warehouse them. We'll just warehouse the bottom 15%. And then we'll create drug laws that then create a system, and we'll monetize this whole system. We'll make money off of the warehousing of this bottom 15%. And we'll, you know, it doesn't matter what happens to the communities. It doesn't matter what happens to these individual lives. It doesn't matter what happens to our society at large. You know, and at that point, you might as well just say, kill the poor.
Right.
Because that's pretty much where
What's
we're
happening.
At.
Yes.
And the bottom 15%, we are making money off of the bottom 15% because we just don't have we things like NAFTA and other government interventions into the free market. We've destroyed entire industries. And so, you know, in lower income areas, not just in like downtown Detroit or Crown Hill here in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. you know, in Scottsville, Indiana, you know, where the Scott County, where the
heroin
epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
You go travel the majority of this state, and the majority of this state in Indiana is poor rural people. And the fastest growing number, the fastest growing population in prisons and in drug rehab is white women.
Mm.
And it's because of prescription drug mills.
Right. Right.
And now heroin, because people have gone to that because you hurt your back and then you get hooked on pain pills and you get all that. You know, so
and then they make it harder to get the pain pills, so it, and they make it more expensive to get them because they see now the problem that they've created, so they
right.
have to then intervene once again to reform this, that, or the other, and so you drive it further underground. So instead of somebody going to a legit doctor who writes a prescription, then you send them to a pill mill, which has a doctor who's a little shady, but he's going to write you the prescription anyway. Well, then you take steps to shut that down. So now what you're finding is that you have to drive to Kentucky, or you have to drive to Illinois, or you have to drive to Ohio to get your fix. But then even they're cracking down on things. So then you find that it's actually just easier to go to the hard drugs that are available on the street instead of trying to follow the laws as they are.
Yeah.
And when you drive it underground, your local drug dealer cannot call the police to say, hey, there's a guy who's on my corner stealing my business.
Right.
The local drug dealer cannot settle a business dispute in a court of law.
Right.
They cannot file a lawsuit. So you introduce violence into that black market. You introduce violence into people's lives that have not been a part of it because you have reformed them from one way of life to another way of life to another way of life. And now
yeah.
you've driven them into a life of crime because you're trying to help them.
Right.
And the pharmaceutical companies are the new drug dealers.
Oh, yes, they are.
And to speak to Chris's point about the institutions of incarceration and the educational system, unfortunately, there's so much money being made by privatizing the prison system that it would only take a fraction of that monies that are being generated to keep our schools open.
Sure.
You know, to keep those factories flourishing and to have jobs for people and those type of things. And it's just amazing that the greed has become so overwhelming that, you know, it's not enough. You know, I watch these NBA players getting $140 million, you know, just to run up and down the court and shoot a basketball. You know, these entertainers, you know, they make so much money. And it's like, but we don't have money for our schools and our neighborhoods and this, that. You know, I mean, we've got money to go after Jeff Teague and Paul George and all these people here in the Pacers organizations, you know, but yet our schools are closing around us. Our businesses are closing around us. We're failing as a community all around us, but we've got this money to go in our pocket and pay this person but it's our fault because we continue to frequent places like Lucas Oil Stadium, you know, just because we go for the entertainment.
Yeah, well, and that's why libertarians would argue that, you know, you can pay a basketball player $140 million because that's private versus public with schools, right. And that's why it's failing. Right, right, and right. So you get this institutional bureaucracy that encourages failure, although sports teams in Indianapolis are no longer necessarily private.
And across the country because they're being subsidized through the stadiums that they build and the arenas that they build that the taxpayers pay for.
Right.
And taxpayers are on the hook for even after they're destroyed, the RCA Dome.
So you have, you crack down on marijuana in the 60s, so then that rises cocaine in the 70s, then that gives rise to crack in the 80s, then that gives rise to meth in the 90s and 2010s, and then, you know, then it becomes pain pills, and now it's heroin again. I mean,
heroin has come back.
Yeah, because it's cheaper than pills. Yeah,
right.
It's all opiates.
And we're actually seeing now, and I saw a report, I haven't had a chance to read the entire thing, but the prescription drugs are now the cause of more deaths than heroin and cocaine combined.
Yeah.
I believe
that. So I want to read a quote from John Ehrlichman, who was the White House Domestic Affairs Advisor during the Nixon administration. Ehrlichman and Haldeman were the main advisors to Richard Nixon. And this is an absolutely true quote from the 90s that he gave to someone. You can look it up if you want. Share it. It's on our Facebook page. I posted it July 9th. On our Facebook page, the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. So here's a former advisor to the president who sat in the Oval Office and in the 90s is admitting to destroying leftist and black communities to win an election in 1972. And that continued with Just Say No and Nancy Reagan and Tough on Crime and then the Clintons with the crime bill in the 90s. And then, you know, after 9/11, we were all conditioned to say, all right, let's militarize the police forces. Let's build a spying apparatus.
Let's set up a video game like display where we can go and kill brown people halfway across the world just because of who they're related to.
Exactly right. So we have to roll back what. So if a politician can create this, then a politician can destroy it. If people go along with that, if people see the truth and start to hear words like that and hear that. Oh, wow, Nixon was trying to destroy black people. He wanted to make it illegal to be black. And so and it's because of the summer of 69. So in the summer of 69, there were a lot of riots. Mm-hmm. 68, 69, 70, there was a ton of violence in the 70s and riots. Reason just posted an article on that, which we reposted at our Facebook page. It was a much more violent time. I mean, yeah, I was a kid when the riots happened in L.A., you know, Rodney King, and then the trucker, Denny, he got pulled out and beaten. I mean, the L.A. riots were massive. And, you know, Baltimore and Ferguson didn't have anything on what happened in L.A. And all of this rioting was, well, we don't condone rioting because it is the destruction of private property for usually people who have nothing to do with the system. there is an understanding that when a people feel occupied, when a people feel oppressed, when a people feel injustice, there will be protests. There will be movements against that. There will be violence because people, you know, some people don't have the emotional stability, I mean, i.e. Maya, to handle the proper way to deal with things, which is nonviolence, which is, you know, doing what Richard is doing, building coalitions locally to influence local legislators, local people through hearts and minds. That's what we're doing. We're not trying to force anybody to do anything. We want you to hear Daron and Richard's story and say, this is happening. You need to care. And it just because it isn't happening to you, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't care. You know, if there were a podcast in 1939 on the German internet, and Jews were brought onto the show and were saying, listen, this is what's happening in the ghettos. This is the attitude towards the Jews by our government. This is a systemic problem. This is institutional racism meant to destroy a race of people.
And every bit of it was legal.
And every bit of it was legal and patriotic and encouraged.
Right.
That's what's happening. We have every single day a young black male, every 2 days, a young black male is killed by a police officer. And in the stories of Richard and Daron, you hear why and how. Because the system has been built into something that... I said it on last episode. I heard it from a CNN commentator who just wrote a book about the police killings. And I can't think of a young black commentator, Mark something. But he just basically said, from the second that black bodies hit the American soil, the state, the governments of America have been trying to destroy those black bodies. And this rash of shootings by police towards young black males is not new. This is an old fight. It's just we're now seeing it with video cameras. And the silent majority, i.e. white people, are now going, holy shit, this is being done in our name. And I think that if you are listening, you need to take an active role in being a leader in your community as a libertarian who cares about freedom and liberty for every individual and every human being, and take a stand and tell your local government, I believe in the dignity of the individual. I believe in the human rights of individuals, and we aren't going to stand for this anymore. So if it means putting body cameras on every police officer that cannot be shut off, because in the case of Sterling, they had body cameras, but somehow those body cameras didn't, they weren't running.
They got jarred. Dislodged.
Yes, that was the word they used,
dislodged. Which is interesting, because I've seen GoPro cameras on the top of guys that are doing crazy motorcycle stunts, right. And surprised to be alive.
Right.
When that stunt is over, when something bad happens,
still
because
filming.
That's typically when we see those videos, but they're still filming.
Yeah. Yeah, so body cameras, and we as citizens need to use the camera that is in our pocket at all times. The second you get pulled over, white, black, Hispanic, whatever, you turn on Facebook Live, and you don't load it onto your phone, you load it onto a cloud service like Facebook Live,
right,
because
away.
Then they can't delete the footage.
Chris, I'd also like to add, when you say that there are two black young men killed every day by the police, systemically, the number is so much larger, mm-hmm. because those are people who actually die and expire.
Sure.
But you also kill us spiritually, especially people like Daron and myself, when you incarcerate us, and then our mental health of coming back, like we were discussing earlier, you have the world as your oyster. You see it, and mm-hmm. we see it completely differently because our spirits have been crushed for so long that we're not able to function the same way people who have never been incarcerated. So once we have interaction with the police and then we end up in the system, then now our understanding of what we're able to achieve changes. And so basically you kill us spiritually as well. So that number of just, you know, two every day is, I mean, because there's countless people out here who no longer see a vibrant life ahead of them mm-hmm. because of the experiences, the things that they've gone through on a daily basis. And so now it's like, wow, you know, I've lost hope. You know what I mean? And people like Daron and myself are rare. We are rarities because throughout all the time that we've done of being incarcerated, our hope never changed. We always felt like at some point we would be able to get back out here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not completely normal as of yet. However, like I said earlier, I'm getting a lot better at my vision of what's possible. And that's why what I share with you about what we're trying to do in the community and that type of thing. And what I'd also like to say is that, you know, there are so many young men out here saying, well, I can't get a job, and there are so many doors being closed in my face. If you're an ex-offender who is now being released, there are jobs out here,
mm-hmm.
okay? There are jobs. I hear about jobs all the time. I constantly am on the phone calling people and connecting people with jobs. There are people out here willing to hire ex-offenders because that stigma is changing as far as they're called returning citizens now, no longer calling them ex-offenders because they're trying to remove the stigma of, you know, not being employable. If you really want to do better, you can do better.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of you have to shake off that cloud, that black cloud of ugliness. And there again, you know, it's a black cloud of ugliness. But that cloud of ugliness that says that you can't make it, that you can't do it because of what you've gone through and because of that label that's on you. And it's just not true. If you come out here and you put your head to the grindstone, it may not take off and happen overnight. But if you just keep plugging, the bottom line is there are people who will give you opportunities, such as the Libertarian Party. I mean, I really believe that there are so many people out here who care that it is impossible to say that you can't.
Sure.
So
I want to jump back to something when he was talking about, and you were talking about the two young black men killed every day. We're also discounting by not mentioning the disruption you mentioned in episode 160, the trauma that takes place growing up. How traumatic is it to see the male role model in your life dragged away in handcuffs?
Sure.
Constantly. How traumatic is it to see the male role model in your life when you're 4 years old sitting in the back seat of a car? Maybe it's not your dad, but Philando Castile had a four-year-old in the back seat of the car, and he was shot four times by a police officer right in front of that little girl.
And then she was the one having to comfort her mother at 4 years old.
Right.
That is a...
And so we're talking about...
From an emotional standpoint, that is a massive codependent that has just been created that has a massive codependent myself. It's a long road to recovery from that little moment that girl just went through.
And we talk about... And you see the other things that are happening in the community because of a lack of economic prosperity. There's endorsement of economic policy that shuts that door to prosperity to a lot of the communities that are affected that we're talking about. And so you have that already working against you. You're starting to see that the male role models in your life and now some female role models in your life are being carted away and locked in a cage for years and years and years and years. And you might get to see them through the glass every once in a while. We're seeing their deaths happening in front of these children. What are we doing emotionally, psychologically, and mentally to these kids that they're not even cognizant of what's actually happening in the world? They only know what they've seen in their microcosm.
Yeah,
and is she going to grow up hating the police?
She might.
You know, it's a scary concept because, what are we creating? By those type of situations.
It's very similar to the conditions that we create when we are drone striking people halfway across the world.
Yep,
we are the biggest recruiters for terrorism. You take a look at what's happening in the police versus black community. If we're going to have that dichotomy in that war, you're recruiting more people to hate the police in the same way that our foreign policy is recruiting more terrorists to hate America.
And let's be really frank. I mean, we kind of talked about a little bit about this before you guys got here. Say there's 100 murders a year in Indianapolis. 80% of it is black-on-black crime.
Right.
I mean, culturally, there's a problem, would you say?
Yes, I would say. And that is what I feel needs to be first addressed as far as a black man. I honestly feel that...
Because you're more likely as a black man to be killed by another black man than a police officer.
Than the police officer, right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I think that the reason that is because we have become so devalued by every other race because we don't value our own. You know, when you get to the place where, I shot John and he was another black guy and nothing happens, there's no recourse. The police are not kicking in everybody's door in order to find out who did it. You get to the place where it's like, oh.
Hopefully they wouldn't be kicking in doors to find people.
Right.
They had an actual reason to kick down the door.
Well, but to say to that extent, sure. When you say that, if I killed a white man, they would kick doors in and to find out. We are going to find out mm-hmm. who did this.
Absolutely.
But because it's a black-on-black crime, no one really cares. And so, therefore, when you get to the place where that's the standard— You know, we as a race have to recognize, okay, this is not everyone else's problem. This is our problem. We have to start at home to say, we need to stop killing each other. We need to stop robbing each other. What is it that makes me feel like I can go and shoot Derone and it's all right,
mm-hmm.
but I hesitate to pull the trigger because you're white.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that I'll probably get away with it if I kill him. There'll be more... A search and you know what I mean, more intensive scrutiny if I kill a white man.
Well, and to be quite honest, if you're in a neighborhood where Derone lives and you kill him, people probably aren't going to talk to the police.
There you go.
You come here, my neighbors are all going to. Well,
I saw this black guy on the porch, and I know that and there's his car right over there. And yes, right. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, if you want justice, then the community and the police have to find a way to start working together and. The stop snitching movement, I think, is a real problem that curtails justice.
Okay, here's where we're gonna kind of disagree a little bit.
You're more than welcome. I'm not gonna fight you.
Listen to you. I believe.
Whatever you say,
I believe
sir.
What you're saying has some validity. However, we had a really interesting discussion yesterday, me and some colleagues, and we were talking about. How other people seem to choose our leaders for us.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, how do I do that? Because I don't want to put anybody's name out there. But there are some organizations out there that are the face of the mm-hmm. black community.
Sure.
Okay. Even to the point of, I will say our deputy mayor. Mm-hmm. Okay. I do not agree. I honestly believe that there was a reason that they separated church and state. Okay, and I do not believe that a person who is a minister or a pastor of a church should be our deputy mayor. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's just my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because what the police department has done basically is to take our so self-proclaimed leaders, and now they've basically made them. Extensions of the police,
mm-hmm.
and they're making the congregations confidential informants. Now, do I believe that the community needs to step up and say something when a child is killed and that type of thing? Absolutely. So don't think that I'm saying this is about a snitching thing, because you have to understand the word snitching and what it really means.
Okay.
When you snitch on someone, that means that the person that you're telling on has some type of connection to you. In other words, you're biting the hand that feeds you.
Gotcha.
Okay? That's snitching. If you kill a young child, if you rape a grandmother, that's not snitching. That's getting that's eradicating your community of a piece of crap.
Right.
Okay? And so, you know, we have to define and understand the difference. And our young people, unfortunately, all they know is what they see on TV. All they know is what they see through the social media. And we've got to get these young people to understand that it's not about prison ain't cool no more. There's nothing cool about going to prison. Snitching, you know, snitching is what snitching is. But the bottom line is when you are giving, providing information to eradicate your community of someone that you don't even want, just like I talked about when I was here before, I understand that there are people who are need to be incarcerated because I slept next to them. I ate with them every day. I understand that there are people who don't need to see the streets anymore because this is a vile, truly, you know, unrehabilitatable person.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I just think that we really need to understand that when we talk about our leadership and who's representing our communities, we need to make sure that it's someone that the community has endorsed, not someone that the police department has endorsed. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's really happening.
I want to add something, a little bit of nuance to what you just described with regard to snitching and talking. Daron, how likely would you be to just talk to the police if you knew something based on your prior experience?
Quickly now.
Now,
yeah,
but
why is that?
But knowing what you've been through in your life, you think about your first encounter. Mm-hmm. Is that something that makes you apt to want to talk?
Oh, I see exactly where he is because you have to be hesitant because I would have answered the question completely different, and the only reason I would have answered it differently is because I understand how things can be twisted.
Yes.
Your signing of the whatever.
That's exactly what I mean. Yeah. I know that Daron has a very different situation today than the day he walked out of jail.
And right.
Because right now, Daron is a father figure.
Right, right.
To two wonderful girls and a little boy. And so, and not to mention his daughter and grandchildren.
Yes, yes.
So, but beyond that, we also have the problem of not being able to trust that what you say is going to be well represented in the way that it is received. We see that from a civil liberties perspective, mm-hmm. and we talk about not talking to the police. You have lawyers that tell you do not talk to the police.
First thing they tell you in the class,
no police contact. So we have to figure out the nuance of the position where we are actually helping, and a lot of it comes back to whether or not we're going to outsource responsibility, because mm-hmm. we can take responsibility and say, I know that this person did this. And that is they aggressed against this person, and I want to make sure that they pay for – that justice is served. Not necessarily that they pay, but justice is served for the victim of their crime. But we have to figure out the nuance because we have so many people who go in with that mindset that end up wearing silver bracelets
there you go.
And walked into a courtroom, and they then somehow become a part of it.
Right.
If they weren't, someone in their family was.
You're right. Exactly right.
But the thing is, the scary part is okay, you're admitting that I saw this happen.
Yes. And you've just painted a target on yourself.
However, if they connect me to that individual in any way, it becomes, I was part of the conspiracy because this happened.
Mm-hmm.
If I said, well, you know what? Daron did this, and I saw him do it. Well, the next thing is, how do you know Daron?
Right.
And how close are you? Absolutely.
What were you doing at this place at this time?
They have two suspects as opposed to someone telling on someone.
And so that's part of the systemic issue that we see with the lack of respect for civil liberties.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have to think about it in a way. It always comes back to looking out for number one. You always have to look out for yourself.
Sure.
Before you can, because you have to make sure that you are taken care of before you take care of others. Mm-hmm. Before you work to better the community, you have to make sure that you're in a good place.
But that's also the very same mindset that is killing the black community, because we've gotten to the point where we've become individualistic as opposed
to community. And I'm okay with people being individualistic as well as being communitarians. The issue for me is how do we present the nuance that we have to protect you from going to jail when you know something.
When I'm trying to do the right thing.
When you're trying to do the right thing.
Sure.
We even see it with whistleblowers. We see it with Edward Snowden. We see it with Chelsea Manning. We see it with all of these people who have stood up and said, I see something wrong. But the system that is in place punishes them.
By the way, Chelsea Manning tried to commit
suicide
this past week. Her lawyers were not told, but the media was told.
Well, that was awful convenient. And
yep.
Great timing right after everything that happened with Hillary Clinton.
With Hillary.
Can I give you an example of...
Yes, sir.
I think it was like 6 months after I got out and I was driving a car. So I'm driving and I'm on 30th Street, but I'm going east. And as I'm driving past, I see a body just laying in the street. Don't know if it's dead or not, but I know when I was out before, in the early 90s, you don't go check on somebody laying down because they can just rob you if you go check. I go down a little bit more and I call off the police. Hey, I just seen someone laying down in the middle of the street. Oh, did you do it? I swear. I'm like, do what? I'm just reporting. I think I'm doing the right thing. I'm reporting that I see somebody laying in the street. I don't know if he's breathing. I don't know. Well, did you see somebody hit him? No, I didn't. They said, okay, we'll send somebody there. It wasn't a month later, a detective called me. Which way was you going? Was you going eastbound, westbound? And where was the body at?
Interrogation.
I'm like, I thought I just did something positive. Well, we don't know, and we don't know what happened, so we got to interrogate everybody. I'm like,
it's part of holding somebody responsible for what happened and not necessarily seeking justice.
Do you think, Brett, that had you or I called, that we would have gotten the same treatment as Jerome?
Probably. Well, I probably would have stopped. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I mean, I stop for people that are in need, that need help often.
I would have kept driving.
Considering the neighborhood.
Right.
No, it doesn't matter.
You say east on 30th Street. I was like, I knew, because I'm picturing
exactly
it. And I'm like, nah.
I don't live that far away. Right. Considering the neighborhood and the situation and where I was going, I may not have stopped. I may have called. But I actually refused to dial 911 unless it is an absolute life or death emergency.
Because it connects right back to you.
But it still does when you call the non-emergency number, but I don't want to tie up actual emergency resources for something that's not an emergency, although we now find out that they just route those right into 911. But
Listen, if they don't give me my fries with my Big Mac at McDonald's,
911.
I'm calling 911 because that is theft, okay? So I paid a lot of money for those fries.
To answer your question, I think that we would have been treated very differently. I don't even think we would have gotten the follow-up call a month later.
Because of how we sound
on the phone.
Sure.
I got the follow-up call because once they ran who I was.
Sure.
They saw that you were an offender.
And they're like, oh, he could have done that.
Sure.
Trying to get out of it.
Yeah.
Right.
So let's talk about the idea of the community, because I don't think that this is a concept that a lot of white people understand. The concept of the black community. When I think of black community, I think Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, and those are two people that I don't necessarily. It's not that I dislike them, but I kind of look at Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson as hucksters. You know, who maybe they do good for the black community. Maybe from your perspective, they do. But from my perspective, I've just been conditioned by Rush Limbaugh to think that they're hucksters.
I don't like them.
Okay. And so when I think of the black community, I think of pastors trying to take advantage of situations. And I was watching, there's a show called Blue Bloods. And listen, my experience with the black community, it comes from SVU. It comes from Blue Bloods. It comes from from movies. And their Reverend Potter, he was, you know, basically there was an issue between the police chief and this black pastor, and the black mayor is trying to do all this stuff. And, you know, then he gets arrested by the end of the episode for extortion. You know, and I think that is the concept that most white people have of what the black community is. And because there is no white community, if I sat here and talked about my white pride and how proud I am of the white community, you know, you're going to start looking for the Iron Cross on my body somewhere, or, you know, that's just not a concept that white people understand. So can you explain? Don't try to explain the black community to me.
No, Brian. Actually, I was going to talk about there are...
Where you're from in Georgia, I'm sure there is a lot of white community pride.
Actually, not where I'm from in Georgia, not so much. But what I was going to point out is there are actually...
Stone Mountain, perchance?
Well, I didn't grow up there.
Okay.
No, I was actually going to talk about a lot of it has to do with where you're from. There's a lot where my family in Chicago lives and is from. There's a lot of German community. There's a lot of Polish community. There are a lot of things that happen specifically within those communities. So there is that pride in your heritage from what country in Europe you came to America from.
Sure.
Yeah. And yeah, that's there.
A long line of German Americans, so there is German pride.
But there is no overarching white community of people who are of English descent and German descent and Spanish descent, and there's not an overarching group in that way, but we do sub-collect. And I do have a lot of things that I don't really talk about with you guys, but you see it like when we go for Dingus Day and stuff that is Polish and is part of my heritage. And, you know, a lot of people forget that I'm only the third generation born in America in my family.
I'm German, so we don't celebrate anything.
You're doing it wrong.
I'm good German. I was here after slavery and before the Nazis. So like,
but I think that he brings up a valid point because in the black community, we are unable to celebrate our individual heritages as far as the different tribes that we may have come from. Mm-hmm. Because we don't know. It's been eradicated because we were brought from slavery over, and now it's just the black community. It's not the Polish, the Nazis, the Puerto Ricans. You know what I mean? We have and that's one of the biggest things that I find is a problem is that we don't identify ourselves with anything.
Right.
And because we don't have that heritage, we don't have that sense of pride. I marvel at the Mexican-Americans, the Latinos or the immigrants that come over here and all of a sudden from absolutely nothing, they're running things. Mm-hmm. But we've been here all this time and we ain't running nothing. You know, we have a black president. A lot of people say, well, you know, because we have a black president, things will change, da-da-da. No, as long as Congress and Senate has the power to veto and stop things from being passed, just because you have a black face in office does not mean that there's going to be justice and equality for all.
And if anything, it feels like we're more divided racially.
More polarized in the last decade.
Than before Barack Obama was in office. And I don't know, I'm not going to pin that on him.
Mm-hmm. No. I think, though, that his ascension to the presidency may have had a reaction that helped to polarize that.
Right.
But I don't know that I would directly.
Well, I certainly think you see the use of white supremacy by Donald Trump as a tool to get elected.
Yes.
Which would show scary. You.
Right.
That it still exists.
Exactly. Of course, I mean, I don't know if it was just me, but, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people have noticed. You don't hear about the KKK anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, you think they died? They disappeared? You know, no, they just have become more savvy in the way they do things, and they're smarter. And this is the thing, you know, we have to understand where we are, and we have to understand what we're up against. And unfortunately, for those of us who are trying to be inclusive and not trying to be separatists, those who want to have that kumbaya moment of a melting pot and everyone doing the right thing. And, you know, we've got to understand that we have to eradicate a whole bunch of stuff before we're even going to get close to the kumbaya. Mm-hmm. You know, there are just so many things that need to be changed, adjusted, reviewed, looked at, turned upside down. Because, like I said, you know, those who were lynching us not too long ago are now, you know, have understood that, well, let's kind of take this and become political with it. Mm-hmm. Let's kind of just, you know, disappear and take this white man killing black men off the table. But at the same time, we can do it another way. We can let the people in uniform do it. You know, it's just amazing how it's the same result. You can say what you want, but the bottom line at the end of the day is we are still dying. And one of the main things that I'd also like to share is that while we are dying out here in the streets daily, while we are dying, it makes it very difficult for me to process what's going on politically. to have a certain type of opinion. If I've got to worry about my family, my son being killed, I don't care nothing about the vote. I don't care who's voting. Right. I don't care who's running for office. I don't care about all these other things that everyone else thinks is such a big deal. But it is a big deal.
It's the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean,
there you go. Right. But if my babies are dying, then that's my most important survival.
Sure.
And that's not a thing that Chris and I are thinking about on a daily basis, which is why we have the time.
Right.
And we can make the effort.
Now, I have the most basic needs. I have food. I have water. I have security. I have shelter. I have internet.
Cats.
I have internet. Don't step on my joke.
Well, and then, but here you go. Suppose somebody was murdering cats.
Oh, well, now I'm outraged.
You know what I'm saying?
But were they black cats?
Well, regardless, you're a cat lover. So, I mean, I'm just saying they were, suppose someone was doing that, then in your mind, that's an issue for you that's going to hit home. And so now you may not be as concerned with this little detail of, Bill Clinton passing this law about three strikes you're out, mandatory sentencing, and da da da. So you miss that.
Sure.
And so it's like, by the time you get off of, oh, my baby's down here bleeding and dying, and okay, we've gone to the funeral, we've done the repast, and da da da, and now I'm trying to get myself back together because now I'm living a life without a child. My son is traumatized because he saw his brother shot down in the streets by the police, da da da, and all the things that you have to go through as a black family, and they wonder why we don't vote. Because we don't have time to understand the issues in the way that they need to be understood, because we're dealing with survival issues as opposed to things that are the bigger picture.
Sure.
One thing I want to jump on with the last thing he said about not voting, a lot of it has to do with the fact that, let's face it, you can't.
Oh, boy, the things that they said, the hurdles that you got to jump through.
And so I look back at something, one of the first political lessons I learned when I was talking, when I was considering running for office and I was helping candidates who were running for office. The standard mindset was, it does not matter how you appeal to the black males that you would represent, because in a 4-year cycle, 2/3 of them will not be able to vote again.
Hmm.
Because one, they're going to prison. Two, they are a little more mobile. And they are moving, and so they won't have changed their registration, so they won't be anymore. So you take a look when you get the voter file, and you see black and male in the voter file, and if they didn't vote in the most recent election, you didn't bother to stop. But the common thought when it comes to campaigning is that you ignore the black male, because if it was in a 4-year cycle, 2/3 of them will not be voting. So from 2008 to 2012, 2/3, if that number, and again, this is just standard campaign tools and tricks and techniques, things that I learned, then that means that 2/3 of the people who voted in 2008 that were black males that voted in that presidential election did not vote in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Or they did not vote in that same geographic area in 2012.
Never even thought of that as a concept.
But one of the things you can do is you can go to the black women, because the black women are
stable.
They are the matriarch. They are the ones that are holding everybody together.
You are absolutely right.
And so when it comes to appealing to the black community, it does not matter what either one of you think.
Right.
Regardless of your status as a voter. I want to know
what the female thinks.
Yes. I want to know what your fiance thinks.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know what your fiance thinks.
Because, never having had a relationship with a black woman, I'm just guessing you do whatever she says, right? That's the reputation.
Well, no. What it is that, and what people don't really understand is that for the black female, she is the one that has good credit.
Mm-hmm.
She is the one that basically is the consumer. Has the economics and deals with the economics in the family, because usually we were in prison,
right?
And so therefore she has the stability.
Yep.
And so therefore that's why their vote matters, because they're the ones that has the money in order to go out and buy cars and do this, that, and the other, and feed the family, what have you. We have been basically destroyed as head of household.
Mm-hmm.
And now most females, all you have to do is look at tax returns. Most of the females are listing as head of household.
Mm.
He brings a valid point. And I'm glad you brought that insight, because just like Chris said, there's a lot of people who don't know that, and they don't understand the systematic ways that they make it more difficult for not only black men to vote, but whether or not their vote counts at all.
So when I was running for re-election, and I was looking at the demographic data and the things that were happening, and looked as a postmortem about how the voters in the district actually showed up, what I found was that despite having 45% of the registered voters in the area where I ran that were black, and nearly 50% of the people that lived in that district were black, the voter turnout in my particular election, 6% of the black, of people that were identified as black in their voter registration showed up to vote for that particular election, which meant that about 80% of the people who showed up were white and made the decisions.
Right.
And the 14% that showed up, surprisingly, were Hispanic.
Hmm.
But it was a district that was very diverse, nearly 50% black, nearly 30% Hispanic, and the remainder was white in the area where I ran for office.
Why do you think that most blacks vote Democrat?
Specifically because most of them don't know the history, and they don't know the history that we were once Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you know, most blacks in most black communities vote Democrat simply because that's all they know. That's what they've been taught.
Mm-hmm.
Through generations, things have changed, and now we no longer I guess side we see the Republicans as bad people.
Well, I think if your community and your neighbors and the people around you, criminal justice reform has to be a large topic. And Republicans,
yes,
you know,
that's not something that
you watch the last gubernatorial debate, and you watch Rupert, the Libertarian, stand up there and you know, have the discussion that we're having and saying, listen, we need to lessen drug offenses. We need to reform the criminal justice system. We're warehousing people for profit, and it's wrong. And then the Democrat kind of says, yeah, I agree with him a little bit, but we still need to do this. And then you've got Mike Pence going, I'm going to strengthen pot laws and
send people to prison.
This will be, this is a
we
quote.
Want people to,
this oh. is a quote. This will be the worst state in the union to commit a crime.
And that's scary.
And that he wanted people to drive around Indiana despite being the crossroads
right.
of America.
Right. You know, I honestly believe that that's one of the issues that in the black community, that my organization Growing Indy is trying to deal with. We are reaching out to people and trying to get people to understand the voting process and the fact that you know, you have independence. You know, you don't have to vote Democrat or Republican or even Libertarian. You can vote as an independent. You know what I mean? And then when you go to vote and they have someone that you like. Just because that person may be a Democrat that you do like doesn't mean that you vote a straight Democratic ticket,
mm-hmm.
that everyone that you vote for is Democratic. Just because you know that one person doesn't mean that all these other people have your best interest at heart. And so those are some of the things that we are trying to teach people. And I personally am trying to teach ex-offenders because that's the one blessing that we do have here in the state of Indiana, that you can vote whether or not you're on probation, parole, ankle bracelet, whatever. When you are released and no longer part of the Department of Corrections, your vote counts.
Mm.
And so, you know, my vision is I know we have at least 20,000, and that's just that's a lowball figure of ex-offenders in the state of Indiana or just here in the city of Indianapolis. And so my vision is to gather as many ex-offenders as possible and create a voting platform and get people to register, and not only register, but understand, you know, what it means to vote. Because I honestly believe, and this is just my personal opinion, that no person should be able to come out of prison and come back to society and be accepted into society if you're not part of the voting process.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just like, you know, you're out of the game while you're in prison. Well, in order for you to get back into the game and be part of the community, you need to be required to vote.
What does it take in Indiana to have your voting rights restored?
All you have to do is register.
Yeah, you
okay?
There is no paperwork you have to fill out. There's not. All you have to do when you come home
is registered to vote.
I believe that once you are incarcerated, your voter registration is voided.
Right.
And then once
so you have to re-register.
You have to re-register at whatever your new address
is. And like
is.
You were saying earlier about moving, if you have not voted, say you register today, and if the next election comes around or whatever, if you have not voted within a certain amount of time,
sure,
you definitely have to re-register if you've moved a certain amount of miles away or whatever into another district. That was my only – and I think that the fear that most of the guys coming home have, it's interesting because I had it.
Mm-hmm.
And I never realized how traumatic and monumental – voting was, mm-hmm, until I finally voted for the first time. And I went in there with my girlfriend and I said, I'll just follow you. Just kind of show me what to do. Because the one thing that we don't want to look is stupid.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. As a guy who's grown and you're a grown man and you got kids and you don't even know how to vote.
Well, you talked last episode about, you know, it was a very powerful statement. It was when you've robbed me of everything, including my dignity, I'm going to hold on to self-respect, and you will not disrespect me. And so that creates a culture of honor. And so if you've read Malcolm Gladwell's, I think it's The Outliers, and he talks about a culture of honor versus a culture of achievement.
Right.
You know, I grew up in a culture of achievement where the achievements are how you gain self-worth, versus a culture of honor where you will not disrespect me, you will not make me feel stupid, you will not make... You know, so cultures of honor have a much different view. So, yeah, you don't want to look stupid. So it becomes, in a culture of honor, it's much harder to have emotional health because you're afraid to admit that you don't know how to do certain things.
And to go into, you also have to understand, too, that usually in, because I'm trying to picture it now, I'm trying to picture what the voting situation looked like when I walked in, because we went to a school. And of course, all of the people there, the majority of the people are older that work the polls.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so these are older black people a lot of times, depending mm-hmm. upon your community. And so now you're even more concerned with looking inept or stupid or unknowledgeable about the process. We walk around with our chests out trying to act like, you know, we got it all together. But that's what everyone does on a daily basis.
Right.
There are things that Chris doesn't know, that Brett doesn't know, that Daron doesn't know, that Richard doesn't know. But we're not going to tell everybody what we don't know because then we're vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so that's kind of the mindset. We don't want people to know that we don't know. And so, like, I whispered to my girlfriend, you know, I'll just follow you and I'll just kind of see what you do. Well, I kind of got freaked out because when they told her to step forward, they told me to stay back. And so she went over to this table and I didn't know what was going on. And I almost turned around and left, you know, and that's the thing. It's like, man, I got to start somewhere, you know. So I said, well, OK, I'm gonna stick it out. And then she knew because when she was done at the end, all it was there's a list that has your name on it, you know, that says where you live and your address and tells you, you know, that you're at the right voting place.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, baby, it's all right. Come on. And I was like, because she knew that I probably was going to bolt. And so she said, no, she said, wait a minute. It's all right. This is just, they're just going to tell you where you are, if you're at the right place or not. And you are, I know you are. And so when she said, well, can we have your name? And I gave her my name. And they start flipping through the papers and they couldn't find me. I was ready to leave then.
Mm-hmm.
And they was like, well, wait a minute. We've got another stack of papers.
Right.
And so they went on and they found me. And I was like, okay. So she was like, okay, now she's behind the curtain doing her thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, can I go see what she's doing? Well, you know, the voting booths are private, but if she doesn't have a problem with you being there, you know. And that's how I learned.
Right.
And I realized that, oh, this is what I was afraid of.
Yeah.
You know, but the fear of the unknown.
Mm-hmm. Right. Fear of the unknown, I think, is the key phrase. And I think that's for everyone. The fear of the unknown is really, I was reading the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. It's a Christian book, and it's in...
Let me dive in for a second, because
yeah,
I just want to say something to you,
yeah.
Chris.
Uh-huh.
I want your list of books.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's you, I forget what the last one you were talking about.
Uh-huh.
The one you said before that one.
The outliers.
That yeah. definitely.
He talks about that in every episode.
And I'm just, you know, obviously, being well read is something that I'm learning.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Darrell and I are very well read because in prison, that's all you have time to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've gotten to the place where now I understand that out here, I have to make that same time for my reading mm-hmm. as I did while I was incarcerated because. That's where I became the intellectual, is while I was reading. And all of the books that have come across, secrecy, the rule of secrecy, there's just so many books that I, the masters, just there's just a lot of, you know, Who Moved My Cheese, basic stuff, you mm-hmm. know, the basic 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, all of that type of stuff. Those type of books have really allowed me to become the person you're listening to.
Yeah.
And so I always look for... recommended reading.
Wait, well, I have a whole list. Yeah. Wait till I get you on Brené Brown. You'll never get off it. But the Screwtape Letters is by C.S. Lewis, and it's a Christian book, and it's letters between an uncle and a nephew, two demons, and the demons are, you know, the uncle is giving advice to the younger nephew who is in charge of making sure that his client goes to hell.
Mm.
And so he is just giving him advice on how to keep him away from the quote-unquote enemy, which is
goodness,
which is the light, which are angels, right. Which are Christians, which are Jesus himself. And he talks about this brief period in every endeavor. There is this brief period. I think it's chapter 2 or 3. In every endeavor that he will take, there is a brief period of time where they're most fearful. It's right before you jump out of the plane. You know, you're always afraid to jump out of the plane. And then once you embark on the endeavor and you don't have all the knowledge and you're not sure and your mind starts wondering and it's like you had the courage to get into the room.
Right.
But it's that period between getting in the room and completing the task that there's that fear and the fear of the unknown. And so I think in every one of our lives, there's always that jumping out of the plane and then that period right after you've made the decision where you really just go, oh, crap. And I imagine that emotional health in men is a disaster. But I imagine in the young black male, it's got to be even worse. And that is a great contributor to a lot of issues within the black community.
Absolutely. There's just so much emotionally that we have to deal with that's on our plate that is, you know, what you're saying is so absolutely true about that fear. And once we get out there and I'm, you know, I'm experiencing it now, you know, I'm in the midst of, you know, here's a person who has done 26 years in prison, who's come home, who's found rejection and all of that. But at the same time, understanding that I have to put one foot in front of the other to continue to move forward because I know what's possible. I know that free will allows me to do whatever I want to do. Mm-hmm. But to be confident and secure and understanding that that will happen for me is very difficult because of my life experiences. Now, it's very important that I finish. And it's just like what you're talking about as far as once you get in it, I'm very vulnerable now that, you know, somebody can just kind of push me over and be like, oh, okay, we got him, mm-hmm. you know. But now I think very, very hard about making sure that I'm here for the long haul and that I'm here to finish the game and I'm here to make sure that what I've started is completed. And like I say, you know, my push is for ex-offenders to realize their potential and understand that, you know, the thing that we were robbed of while we were incarcerated, irregardless as to whether you're guilty, not guilty, the bottom line is when you spend time in the system, it affects you.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you've been affected, that's something you can't undo. You can't go back and unsee the things you've seen. You can't go back and unhear the things you've heard, experience the things that, you know, my girlfriend was looking at my hand the other day, and she was just rubbing my hands, and she realized that this knuckle is way back here. And she was like, what happened? And I said, well, this is the hand that I used to hit people the most. And so, and it was interesting because it was something she'd never considered about the abuse that just this hand has taken. And it was something that I had never considered about how many things that have happened to my body and to the way I thought was based upon my prison experiences. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's just it's really, you have to recognize that it affects you dramatically. And, to your point, I really just believe that now it's all about finishing what I've stepped into and embracing. The most important thing for me is to now recognize the importance of relationships and recognize the importance of meeting people like Chris, meeting people like Brett, you know, understanding that there are so many people out here who are not what we are, not the demons that we think, that are stuck in our heads to say, well, because his skin is white, he's against me. Because this person has brown skin, they don't care about my situation. You know, there are a lot of Latinos, there are a lot of other ethnicities that, you know, for a while I was like, well, because I'm black, I don't care about nothing but nobody but about black people. Mm-hmm. And I realize more and more now that the more people that I allow into my life and I let that guard down and I allow people to come in and give me their views and talk about, you know, the type of confidence that you, Chris, have that just in sitting here talking to you today, it helps me grow confident within myself to say, okay, well, if he feels like the world is his oyster, well, why can't I feel the same way?
Absolutely.
And you know, why can't I, you know, feel like I have an opportunity to go out and I can live anywhere I want to, and as long as I'm making the right kind of money and da-da-da. But we also know that at some point, and I'm honestly, just to be straight up honest, I'm waiting for it because I'm doing so well, okay, with my organization and the things that I'm doing and moving forward and the events that we're planning and the things that at some point somebody's going to pull my criminal history out and drag it out and say, oh, but he's an ex-offender. When we get to the point where we're so big that we're really making positive change, somebody's going to dredge that out and say, look at what a bad person he was, because it's the exact thing that they do when they shoot our people in the streets. The first thing they want to know is, did he have a criminal history?
I've seen Castillo didn't have a permit. I've seen, you know, look at his criminal record for Sterling. I mean, that's the first thing.
Right.
And it's never a black person that does that. It's never, it's always a person that votes largely Republican that is the one publishing on my status. You know, isn't this awful that this black man was killed by a police officer? Yeah, but here's his criminal record.
Right.
And, you know, we just have to get to a point where you have conversations like we've had in these two episodes where people get to meet people like yourself and Daron. Say, you know what? Yeah, they may have done something bad, or they have had something bad happen to them, or they may come from a different culture, or they may come from a different community. But it. So what if Richard used to beat people up? He came into my house. We've had a great conversation. I've asked him questions that I don't think a lot of white people would ask a black ex-offender. Like, so why do you made a face when I said, so why do black people vote Democrat? And then your face twisted, and I went, uh-oh. I'm but you know what? It's not being afraid to talk to each other.
Right,
it's about having a conversation, and that's one of the great things about being involved in Rupert's Kids over the years is getting to meet people in that program that I didn't grow up with. I had a good childhood. Now I had a dysfunctional, chaotic family life. And so, yeah, I did grow up with the fear of this thing over here is out to get me. Mm-hmm. And that thing is always the government, or, you know, your mom's going to yell at you, or, you know, you can't let things get too good, or as soon as you think, oh, life's great, everything's going to go to shit. Mm. You know, like, that comes from growing up in a dysfunctional family. Those are human emotions. And I think once we all can get to the point where we all go, wow, you two went, I may not have gone to prison, but I understand I have empathy for the emotions that you went through. you're a human being just like I am. That's when we really start to connect with each other, and that's when we really start to go, something's got to change because these are human beings. These are not just some avatars on TV, you know, and that's what one of the authors talked about on Democracy Now! That I listened to the other day. I think the book's like The Invisible Man, or like how people like Sterling are nobodies. They're nowhere in the system. They're lost in the system. They're just nowhere. And then this thing happens to them, and they become an avatar for a cause. And even then, with all the candlelight visuals and airbrush t-shirts and, you know, use of fundraiser, all this, all the outpouring of support, they become avatars. We never really even get down to consider their humanity. And we have to. We have to get to a place where we can say, you know what? When I watched the Castile video, I felt empathy and compassion for the officer, to be quite frank. Yeah, he murdered somebody, but you listen to that officer's tone of voice and the panic and he's clearly traumatized by what had just happened, you know? So that's a human being too, just like Castile is a human. So just like the girlfriend, you know, and that compassion, I think, is what we all need to work on and just kind of break down this, you know, we're all running to each other's camps. You know, we're like, here's my talking points. This is a criminal. Sterling didn't deserve to die in a parking lot for having a past, because it's real easy as a young black man in America to get a past, you know. And just because Derone has a felony, that doesn't make him less than a human being. And it doesn't matter a criminal's skin color. You know, it's tough out there for young white males from disadvantaged areas, from poverty-stricken areas. You're a white kid from here in Indianapolis, and you live in Mars Hill or Hallville. You're growing up with a lot of the same struggles. You know, you're struggling. It's that bottom 15%. Any final thoughts, Derone? I mean, that you want to share with people before we wrap up?
I think, like I said in the last episode, I just wish people would understand the criminal justice system better before they judge it, and kind of understand people who's coming out of it, because we are human and everyone makes mistakes, be it small or big, but it's still a mistake. And I don't know. I just guess people should really understand the person who went into the criminal justice system too, because like in my situation, I think I have been owned by the state of Indiana, be it foster home or the criminal justice system, since I was 8 and just got released from, well, I'm still confined by them, but
almost there.
Yeah. A
couple weeks.
And no one would know that if I didn't tell them, but they don't want to see what I've been through. All they want to see is what he supposedly have did. And that's saying that's how we're going to judge him for the rest of his life. And basically, I just want people to understand us more and get to know us and know that we're all not bad people. I mean, even though they say we did something bad, we made it out of there, and that's something positive itself.
Mm-hmm. Brett?
I just, you know, I'm Derone and I have been friends for 2 years now. Mm-hmm. Like I told in episode 160, Derone was the first friend that I made up here after I moved up here. And for those of you who listened to episode 160, when Derone was talking about what it was like when he was interrogated and the plea bargaining conversations, and even when we talked before the show about what Derone was charged with, that was never stuff that we discussed until that day, because it didn't matter to me. And I think that if we are communicating with people and we are learning about people and we are befriending people that are different from us, we're going to have an enriched life. We're going to have an engaging conversation, I hope. We're going to have, you know, I've had the opportunity to also become a part of, I won't say her name, but Derone's girlfriend, mm-hmm. and her kids, and getting to know them. And to me, it's an enriching part of my life. And while I knew before we talked on that episode why, like what you were charged with, just because part of the due diligence for working with Rupert's kids was knowing what, you know, if in the event that we were going to an event that had kids, we wanted to make sure there wasn't anybody who had any, you know, issues with minors and things like that. So it was necessary for me to know, but I didn't know the story. Yeah. I knew what I saw on mycase.gov, and that's what I saw, but to me that didn't matter, and I wish that more people would take a look and see that a case file does not define a person.
Right.
And we talked about that with Sterling. You look at his case file, because that's basically all it is a bunch of charges and dates.
Right.
You don't know the story. You don't know that the girl that he went to prison over for having an age inappropriate relationship in the eyes of the state later had his kid, and I believe they were engaged at one point after he got out of prison. You don't see that when you just read a case file. You don't get to know the person. And so until you get to know the people and until you're engaging with people that are different from you, you're not going to – your experience is not going to be enriched. And I think that if we took the time to understand and not judge based on a one-off instance or what we may or may not know or a case file or whatever it is, whatever the situation is and how we came to meet them, we're going to have a better life, period.
Richard?
Yes. I'd like to also share that we have a new program that we're starting called Peer-to-Peer Recovery, where we are mentoring each other, ex-offenders who have come home and who have basically acclimated themselves back into society and are doing the right thing, are now reaching out to ex-offenders who are just getting out and trying to show them how to walk the walk and take those steps in order to be becoming self-sufficient and acclimated back into society. We talk about voting. We talk about all of those things that we talked about here on the show today. There is an event coming up on July the 30th. It will be held, and we're asking everyone to come out. We're asking all walks, all nationalities, all races, all the ethnicities. We're asking everyone to come out and support this event. It's being sponsored by Peacekeepers 2, whose CEO is Horatio Luster, who used to be part of the 10-Point Coalition, but they branched off into doing other things. We at Growing Indy are partnering with this organization. We also have like 60 other businesses that have partnered with the organization as well for this particular event on July the 30th. It'll be held at School 69. It's a parking lot right there on the corner of 34th and Keystone. It is 3421 North Keystone Avenue. We're asking everyone to come out. We're going to have people who now we started planning this event before all of these tragedies came up.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happens that in the midst of all the shootings and the deaths that have occurred, we're going to have representation from the mothers of and families of people who have lost loved ones. We're going to give them an opportunity to be there. We're asking for the mayor. We're asking for law enforcement. We're asking for fire department people. We're asking for anyone who has a business that wants to be a part of it. We will attach your name to it. Like I said, we already have about 60 organizations, and the list is growing. We did not want to do what most people are doing. Everybody's trying to pop up with a quick march and a quick this and say about the killings and that type of thing. We wanted to give it 30 days because we wanted to plan something that was organized and make sure that it had some effect. We're tired of just talking. We want some solutions. And so when I say that, what we're going to do on the 30th is we're going to, first of all, show up. And that's one of the biggest things in the Black community is making so, and you can see it with our voting turnout. We want to show that not only can we show up, but we can show up and be involved in a process that's about the right thing. Once we show up and they see
this mass of people, this mass of humanity, all colors, all shades, all ethnicities, then we're going to talk about how we can move forward in making sure that our voices are heard. Of course, we're going to have some demands because there are things that we want. We don't want to continue to be recognized by the police department or the city, the local city government, to say who our leaders are. We want to pick our leaders. We want leaders from the ground roots level. We want leaders from the neighborhood, people who are doing well and doing the right things in the community. You know, just because you pastor a church and you've got a bunch of money, that doesn't make you my leader. I want a leader that I see on a regular basis every day. I want a leader that I have his phone number on speed dial, that I can call him when there's something going on in my community. I want to be able to not only talk to him, but to not be alienated to the point where I can't contact the police when something's going on. You know what I'm saying? I don't want someone to have to, well, I got to tell you, and then now you're going to tell the police for me. You know, I want someone that truly represents the type of area that I live in and understands my struggle. And so we want to pick our own community leaders. And that's one of the things that we're also going to do on the 30th, is make sure that anyone who wants to be a part of what we're doing becomes a part of it. And then once you're given a seat at the table, definitely your voice will be heard. I just really think that this event is going to change something. And I think that the reason it's going to change something, because first of all, people are going to see that we can actually come together. You know, a lot of times, I've gone to a lot of events and there's seven people in the room. There's three people in the room. And it is so discouraging when you're trying to do something that is so positive that you know will help the community and no one shows up. Well, this is something different. And this is why we chose to take a longer period of time to try and organize and assemble it, is because we wanted to make sure that it was successful on a larger scale. And this is just the very beginning. So please come on out July 30th. Everyone's welcome. 3421 North Keystone Avenue from 3 p.m. to 7 o'clock in the evening. And I'm sure that afterwards there'll be networking sessions. Everybody will be passing out cards and getting to know one another. And then from that, we intend to ask that everyone come back and bring one more person. Mm-hmm. And so we intend to multiply.
How can people get in touch with you?
You can get in touch with me through Growing Indy. My number is 317-992-8236. That is not an office number. That is my personal number, and you'll be able to talk to me immediately. And I am willing to, I'm looking for anyone who is an ex-offender who is looking to become a part of our peer-to-peer recovery program. And that's one of the things that I was talking about with you, Daron, that I wanted to get with you, because I know your passion for reentry and making sure that people who have experienced the things that we've gone through to not have to continue to experience that. And so hopefully you will become one of our mentors as well. And you know, it's just a matter of making sure that we take someone who has just come out and basically showing them what, you know, we've already been through. So, yeah. And Chris, I really appreciate the opportunity, man, yeah. Coming back and talking to you. Brett, it was definitely nice seeing you again.
Yes, sir.
I just have to say that he
doesn't get that very often. So
I have to say that I miss Chloe. So, Chloe, wherever you are, you know, hope you're having a great time. And like I said, thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you, Daron. Thank you, Richard, for coming here and sharing your story with our listeners. I know the first episode, we got a lot of great feedback. A lot of people were really touched by what you had to say. And hopefully it changes a lot of minds. I mean, the national organization that we were talking about earlier, Freedom Works, tens of thousands of people on their social media, they shared it with their group, and they're hopefully going to share this one again so we can get the word out there. You know, I just want to, you know, not to disagree with Richard, because I don't disagree that a community should pick their leaders. I just want to impress upon anybody that's listening, it's one of the foundational principles of libertarianism and our show that we are all our own leader, and that if anyone takes away our right to be our own leader, then that person is wrong, and that person should be fought against, and that is injustice. And
may I?
Absolutely.
And I don't believe that when you say that, that you're disagreeing with me.
Sure.
Because I honestly believe that that is kind of what we're looking for in a community. We're tired of basically having being represented by puppets. Mm-hmm. And yeah. so basically, if we can be taught to be leaders, then we'll have a better understanding of, like I say, I think that you have an understanding of life that is different than our culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're privileged to be able to, okay, well, I can be a leader. Whereas we have been taught there's no leader in us.
Sure.
You know, and so now we're just now getting to the place where we understand that. And so we are definitely looking. I would definitely want someone who understands my experience. You don't have to have gone to prison to understand my experience. But if you're going to represent me, I want you to be able to represent me properly and sure. to know what's important to me. And so that's where we are as far as leadership.
Yeah, I think it's key that every person, you know, my road to self-empowerment was quicker than yours, you know, because of having those needs met quicker and coming from a more stable home or a more stable life than maybe the two of you. And what we want to do here at We Are Libertarians is just explain, like, here's how the people you're voting for impact the lives of people who don't have a voice. You know, the people that you vote for, when you walk into a ballot box, it's life or death. It's life or death for Castile and Sterling. It's life and death for Derone. It's life and death for Harry. It's life and death for Brett and I. The force of the state carries with it death as a finality. If you don't do what government wants you to do, they will bankrupt you, or they will steal your liberty, or they will kill you. And the people that you vote for, you have to vote wisely. You have to make sure that they understand humanity and dignity and individualism, and that we don't want leaders who are going to lead for us because they know best for us. We want leaders who will get the government out of the way so that we may be self-empowered and make choices for ourselves. Because as you heard in this episode in 160, I don't think that Richard and Derone started out thinking that I can make decisions for myself. There is a force greater than I that has me in a funnel headed a certain direction. And that is what we must end as a society, because it is wrong. Self-empowerment, dare I say self-government, for which Brett advocates, is an essential part of libertarianism, and it should be an essential part of anyone you vote for. It should be an essential part of the people that are around you, because you are made up of the five people that are closest to you. So with that, I just want to say thank you to Derone, to Richard, to Brett for this great experience and this great conversation, and to FreedomWorks for sparking this great conversation. And please share episode 160 and episode 164, I believe this is, 163, with your friends and family so we can start changing hearts and minds, because that is what libertarians have to do. It isn't about getting the right... It's not about philosophy. It's not getting the right metrics, my dear INTJs. It's about changing hearts and minds. And that's what we're trying to do here. So please get involved in your community. Get yourself informed. And as we have this national conversation on police versus, let's face it, it feels like it's blacks versus police, but it isn't. It is all of us are in this together, and we've got to find a way to work together.
Thank you for listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Get our other shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.